I'm Lisa Smiley. I'm the Acting Director of Programs and Partnerships at the Public Health Agency of Canada. And on behalf of myself and my co-moderator, Joe Valentine, there at the end of the table, who's the Associate Director for Health Equity in the Division of STD at the CDC, we want to welcome you to this session on social justice for sexual and racial minorities. I'm really excited to bring together today two really dynamic and experienced speakers. The structure of the session today is going to be a little bit different. We're not going to have your typical plenary where each of the speakers is going to do a presentation. Instead, we're going to have a moderated conversation. So the speakers got together and they identified four key questions that will walk you through some key issues in social justice for sexual and racial minorities, right on through to the key question, which is, now what, so what? So what can we do about this? In terms of who our speakers are, we have Mandy Carter, who's an African-American lesbian social justice activist with a 48-year movement history of social, racial, and LGBT justice organizing. Ms. Carter helped co-found two groundbreaking organizations. Southerners on New Ground is building a progressive movement across the South by creating transformative models of organizing that connects race, class, culture, gender, sexual orientation, and gender identity. The National Black Justice Coalition is a national civil rights organization dedicated to empowering Black, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people whose mission is to end racism and homophobia. Eleanor Matika Tyndale is a sociologist and a distinguished university professor in the Department of Sociology, Anthropology, and Criminology at the University of Windsor. Her research focuses on sexual rights and social justice using a community-partnered model. And she's done research not only in North America, but throughout Europe, Africa, and Southeast Asia. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to the speakers.
Good morning. Mandy and I are going to be rotating in terms of responding to the questions that you see in front of you. We thought, as we began talking about the topic, our first thought was, it's important for each of us to position ourselves. Where are we coming from? How did we get into this, after all? And how do we come to take the positions that we've taken? So first, a little bit about me. In the 1970s, I was teaching at a college in Montreal. The province of Quebec has a somewhat unique educational system in North America. After 11 years in primary and secondary, you go on to a college where you do the equivalent of your 12th year of high school and your first year of university. Then you go on to, if you choose, to university for 3 years to get your bachelor's. So I was in that middle range, the grade 12 and first year university. And I was teaching courses on sociology of sexuality as well as statistics. Most of the students preferred the first to the second. At the time, I was doing research related to adolescent sexuality. And all of a sudden, and that included how young adults, how the young people in my classes as well as across the province were responding to things like the herpes epidemic. Do you remember that way back in the 1970s before HIV came along? That was the big problematic issue. And then all of a sudden, in 1981, a colleague of mine became extremely ill, was hospitalized. It was during the flu season. We thought it was related to flu. But as it turned out, similar illnesses were being reported in the United States. And my colleague was diagnosed with what we now know, HIV infection and pneumocystis carini pneumonia. So he was diagnosed with AIDS. Any of you who were there at the on the ground floor at the time, you knew we knew nothing. Panic was spreading, and what happened was we were searching around, the world, people involved in this, were searching around for who knows anything about sexuality, who knows anything about gay lifestyles, gay sexuality, because This was a taboo area for research. In fact, I was one of the few people in the college system in Quebec who was actually doing research on sexuality. And it was hard to find people who were willing to teach these courses because sexuality itself was a taboo. That got me involved right on the ground floor with activism around HIV infection on behalf of people who were infected. I became that sort of, so to speak, safe, middle-aged, heterosexual, married with two children, white woman who could stand up in front of a crowd and not scare them because I did not belong to a identifiable minority. And I could speak to them about issues about sexuality, about HIV and AIDS. This is the way we were thinking at the time. That's where everything essentially evolved. When I finally did my PhD in 1986 on the impact of AIDS on adolescent sexuality, it became a hit. It's hard to call a PhD dissertation is a hit. But it resulted in phone calls coming to me from not only across Canada, but also from places like Thailand and several other countries, asking me to please come and work with them to do research and to help them develop interventions and programs to address this thing that we now had a label for. We now knew, or we were labeling it HIV and AIDS infection. And that's how everything got started for me as a result. I began as an activist and I learned to be a researcher, but the activism and the advocacy has been at the bottom of my research or foundational to my research all along. Those of you who are in the academy know that a higher prestige goes to research that's just for the purpose of research. We don't worry about whether it has a practical application. That's not me, and that's not what I've ever done. I think because of my roots at the beginning of when this infection started, my research focus has always been, how can I do research that's going to lead to something that makes a difference, to lead to programming, to lead to interventions, to lead to government-level strategies, and that's where I go. And it's always done as a result in partnership with community members. Mandy.
Thank you so much, Eleanor. First of all, I want to say thank you for the invitation to be here. Home is right up the next state, North Carolina. Any North Carolinians in the house? I'm sure there's some. I want to thank the co-sponsors, but also particularly Lynn Barkley, who lives in RTP, Durham, not far, and extending the invitation, and for all the logistics stuff that people had to do to make sure we're here. Great to be on a panel with Joe and Lisa. I think when we were talking yesterday about how we wanted to do this panel, we thought it would be interesting to go like 10,000 feet in the air. What was it that planted that seed? Why is it that we're all in this room doing our respective areas of work, whether we're researchers or doctors or activists or whatever? And I thought, you know, if we told that little short story, mine is very simple. I just was at my 50th high school year reunion, Mount Pleasant High School, Schenectady, New York. I graduated in 1966. And my major was college prep because I wanted to be a doctor. But to be a doctor, I had to take a foreign language. The three were French, German, and Spanish. The first two were not going to happen. I flunked Spanish, and at the time it was devastating because if you don't pass that language, you can't get into a four-year. You had to go two-year. But add to this other thing. Our social studies teacher, thank you for social studies teacher Jack Hickey, bought some young white staffer in from a group I have never heard of before, the American Friends Service Committee, Quakers. At that time, they were down south as a predominantly white peace group trying to figure out how they could help organize and be in partnership with the civil rights movement. Three things he said that day is why I'm here 51 years later. Full equality and justice for all. If that is what you're grounded in, your principles and your values, full equality and justice for all, that grounds you. So no matter what the issue might be, that's just part of what the kind of DNA would be. But the power of one, that each and every single one of us has the potential to impact change if we so choose to act on that, the power of one. But it was the third thing that made the critical difference. We have an AFSA high school work camp in the Pocono Mountains. Who would like to go? because there you learned about Gandhian principles of nonviolence, nonviolent direct action, but you had folk coming up from the South talking about what work was happening down there. And they talked about Joan Baez and the folk singer and Institute for the Study of Nonviolence. So that really caught my attention. And where I was living at an orphanage at the time, life happens, they said, if you want to go ahead and go to college, we'll pay for your entire education, Mandy. But it was too late. The seed had been planted. I wanted to be an organizer. So that said, I ended up going to California, and because the war in Vietnam was going on, and King gave his famous April 4th, 1967 speech, Riverside Church, if you remember, beyond Vietnam, talking about the civil rights movement and also about what was happening in Vietnam, but this very simple question, how can you ask black men to go thousands of miles away to kill or be killed in the name of democracy if you don't have that at home from where you came? Got my first job at the War Resisters League, make a long story short, I wanted to go to a WRL office in east of the Mississippi, Durham, North Carolina, and here I am. NBJC, and I'll talk about this more with other parts of our questions, there's a great quote, don't mourn, organize, if there's a need, fill it. NBJC is an organization for those of us who can be out to be visible, to be the face for those who cannot be seen if you can't be out, to be the voice for those who cannot be heard, but also to be advocating, issuing critical issues of the day, and particularly with our historically black colleges, 105 of them here in the South. So that's why we're going to have this conversation today, and I feel honored. And also I have to say, the Congressional Black Caucus just met, the 46th, we were there, and our first ever African-American, Barack Obama, was in that place. Anyone could have thought that in 1963, August 28th, that we would have our first African-American president in our lifetime is beyond amazing. So thank you. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
We started off with a long list of topics that we wanted to talk about, and obviously we had to narrow it down to a few. Mandy and I agree that something that we wanted to address was sexual culture, and in particular, what is the place of STIs in sexual culture? And how does all of this then figure into vulnerability to STIs? Something that I hear all the time, my research involves both surveys, quantitative work, and what we refer to as qualitative work, in-depth interviews. And it doesn't matter where I am, when I ask the question, how do you stay safe from STIs, from HIV? This is what I'm told. Oh, I can tell if somebody's infected, and I just won't have sex with somebody who's infected. She or he isn't like that. No, they're not like that. I trust my partner not to put me at risk. I just don't have sex with people like that. Or those things, they aren't in our group. In the early days of AIDS, countries used to say this. Country after country would say, oh no, this is not going to affect our people because our people aren't like that. We now know that HIV, STIs in general, are worldwide. They're global. What does this say about what is the place of STIs in sexual culture? STIs are the threat. They're the bad guy. They're the piece that's anomalous, that's exceptional, that they're rare, and only certain kinds of people who do certain kinds of things. And notice the crinkling of my nose. That means it's undesirable things. It's things that are viewed negatively will become infected. Well, the reality is I don't have to tell you. STIs are not anomalous. They're not exceptional. If we look especially at the two most popular, HPV and chlamydia, almost everyone encounters them at some point in their lives. So what does this do by viewing STIs as the anomaly? When I was going to high school a very long time ago, I had my 50th reunion a few years ago.
Okay.
When I was in high school, STIs were the threats that were supposed to keep us from having sex. Because if you have sex, you could get one of these horrible diseases. They show these wonderful slides of chancroids and all kinds of ugly things to scare us off sexual activity. By making STIs the bad guy, or by making STIs something that only people who are engaging in undesirable negative forms of sexual activity get, we can't talk about them. We have to be silent about them. To admit that it might be a good idea to be tested, or even to admit, I find in my research among young people, and this is worldwide, that maybe you should use a condom. Why would you use a condom? To prevent that thing that you're not going to be at risk at because you're not that kind of person. Or is your partner that kind of person? By leaving STIs as the undesirable, as the unspeakable part of sexual activity, what we're doing is we're making it almost impossible for people who are sexually active to take action to prevent STIs. I'd like to compare that very briefly to the common cold. I'm a professor. I'm surrounded by students. Guess what happens in the wintertime? A good third of them have runny noses, are coughing, are sneezing. I go to committee meetings. My colleagues are coughing, are sneezing. We know how easy it is to transmit a cold. Oh, yes, I'm told, wash my hands, you know, very carefully. And I do that. But, you know, I get a cold. Nobody blames me. Nobody says, Eleanor, you didn't take precautions. What kind of people were you around? Because we assume that part of human interaction means that we will come in contact with certain kinds of infectious agents, like a cold, like the flu. I'm not blamed. Nobody is stigmatized for having a cold or a flu. But part of sexual activity means we're likely to be exposed to sexually transmitted infections. That's why they're called STIs. And yet, rather than recognizing this as just an ordinary part of our sexual lives, we see it as something that says something negative about us.
Like it.
Sorry, Mandy.
No, it's okay. We have a timekeeper here. We're trying to keep this so we can have time for a Q&A. When I think about this, I'm looking at the title, how does the place of STIs and sexual culture figure into vulnerability? Put the word black sexual culture or black LGBT same-gender lesbian culture. And when I was up in my room, I went back, and does anyone remember this incredible PBS state story they did in 2012, 30 years of AIDS in the black community? I looked at that thing, and I was astounded. The names, I knew the names. I was living in San Francisco at the time, just like we were commenting, Eleanor, where you were. They didn't have a name for it, and when they finally got a name for it, but to sit in a city like, anyone been there, it's a very small, compact town, and there's a publication called the San Francisco Bay Area Reporter. It got so bad that people were afraid to pick up that paper every weekend because you knew name after name after name. And as someone who's black and a lesbian living in San Francisco, to see how the white, and that part there was no B&T, but the white gay community was dealing with it, and also thinking about the black gay community, how it was dealing with it, and for those of us who are African American wanting to be a part of our full community, just how devastating that was. And so what I did, and I don't have any kind of a medical or clinical thing, it's more of a, I was just going through the years, and there were some highlight years that I think would really be key. Because I think part of it might be, where were you when any of these dates had happened? Or why are you at this point in your life and your careers and your vocation deciding this is what you want to do? In 1982, at least, AIDS was named by the CDC. By the way, I need to let you know that NBJC is in partnership with the CDC. I think it's called PAC. You know how you all have initials here, the alphabet soup? It's called Partnership, Partnering and Communicating Together to Act Against AIDS. We're in it, Black AIDS Institute, other National Urban League. It's a great collaboration. I love that. And so here are some of those key. 1982, AIDS is named by the CDC. 1986, the first ever Black AIDS conference was held in the city of D.C. I was there, Phil Wilson, who now founded the Black AIDS Institute. Only one camera showed up for that conference, CNN. And one of the first comments that was made from a doctor in Harlem was this: the second leading cause of death in Harlem is AIDS, but mothers were not going to sign those death certificates because of that. People almost said it doesn't exist because that's a white gay thing. But at the same time, I was profoundly amazed at how the gay white community came together, ACT UP. Silence equals death. Finding ways in which you would have social media, getting out there and being very visible and being very present in 1986. In 1987, we'll have to go down. Does anyone remember the name? There's the quilt, the Names Project. In 1987, there was the March on Washington for Gay and Lesbians. We didn't get the B&T till later. But that was groundbreaking because one of the cultural things that people decided to do, how do you get the message out about how AIDS is devastating? Each panel, what was it? A panel was, and they were all the exact same, 150 foot by 470 foot panels. And the love and dedication that went into putting these panels in, there was 1,920 panels on that mall. And was anyone there in 87, or has anyone seen it? It's online. To stand there in absolute silence, and right up, you could see the White House from there. That was Ronald Reagan. And to understand the power and the impact that had on the culture, the media, and I would almost say, would you not agree, Eleanor, just understanding this is a real deal. Mm-hmm. 87. I was also thinking about the year that Rock Hudson, when he said, I have AIDS, and it was Elizabeth Taylor who stood up and said, this is an issue that we have to talk about and embrace. And now we think about fast forward to when Barack Obama got into the White House. And when he decided to sign the Affordable Care Act, but also had this whole issue around how we have to be public about it, have policy around it, do cultural work around it, and see the difference. So I would say that every conversation we have about STI, HIV, STD, that if you think about the cultural realities of how our communities of color are talking about it, dealing with it, and finding some ways to have conversation in whichever way, and doing that in partnership and collaboration, that to me is the excitement of how we move forward on the issue of social justice and social change and issues that affect all of our communities.
Mandy slid into our next slide on social justice.
So I still get my 5 minutes?
I don't know. I think I'll give you your 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Social justice, sexual rights. What connections do I see between social justice, sexual rights, social determinants, STIs? Yesterday, I was really excited to hear Sheldon Danziger and Mary Bassett's talk, because to me, I didn't need to say anything more. They clearly demonstrated the absolute necessity of a rights and justice foundation to our work. And what they were talking about also reminded me of a World Bank report that I had read several years ago that compared 50 countries, specifically with respect to HIV, looking for what were the societal level factors that were associated with higher or lower rates of HIV infection. And they identified three that they said summarized, I believe it was 80% or close to 80% of the variability in HIV infection. And two of them were very close to the lines that we heard about yesterday. One was economic inequality. The more profound the inequality, the distance between the top and the bottom. And what did we see? We saw growing inequality in Canada. We have a growing inequality in Canada, but not as vast as the growing inequality in the United States between the rich and the poor. The second is gender power imbalance, where you have an imbalance in the power that men and women have, I would say particularly in terms of their ability to take agency in the area of their own sexual lives. That also contributes to higher rate of HIV infection. We're not so bad there in North America. We're better than in many countries, but not as good as other countries. As the third one was the rate of absolute poverty, which again, we heard about yesterday in the presentations. So those were very much in line, and the need for a rights and a social justice, the only way we reverse these is if we approach them from the perspective of rights and justice. But let me give you some examples from my own work. I started doing work in Kenya in 2001. My initial project was in collaboration with a large educational NGO, an NGO that had been working closely with the Ministry of Education on a variety of programs in their schools. And what they had been tasked to do was to develop an HIV/AIDS education program for the primary schools of Kenya. We argue about our secondary schools, for heaven's sakes. This was primary. These are little kids starting at 5 years of age and going up to 12, 13, something along those lines. And because I had worked with adolescents, that was one of those phone calls that pulled me in. Oh, my goodness, 2 minutes. All right, the Kenyan example. What the NGO said to the Ministry of Education was that we will work together, and I was part of this statement, but we need to work from the perspective that youth have a right, notice that word right, to factual information about sexuality and especially about HIV. And that they have a right to an open conversation about HIV and sexuality. I don't think the ministry knew what they were agreeing to, but they did. As a result, the program that was developed was not one AIDS lesson a week. There was that. But talk about sexuality and sexually transmitted infections, especially HIV, was infused in every subject area. So you had math lessons about, so if the proportion is this and the prevalence is that, what, you know, so HIV was brought into math lessons, English lessons, history lessons, language lessons, every single place. What that did, I learned from the research, the evaluation we did of the program, is it opened up the conversation about sexuality and HIV, not only in the school, but in the village and in the community and in the family. The second thing was condoms was a sticky wicket issue. If you've ever were anyone who's worked in sub-Saharan Africa knows that this is one of the toughest topics to talk about. What the ministry agreed to was, and what we agreed with the ministry, was that condoms would not be part of a formal lesson, but every school would have an anonymous question box, and youth had the right to factual information. My colleagues, my Kenyan colleagues said, don't worry, Eleanor, the kids will ask the questions. They did. And the teachers, together with, we had to bring in health workers because the teachers struggled about how to talk about condoms, got the information about condoms. That program, I think, has been part, you can never talk to one intervention or one program as creating massive change, but I think that the program in the Kenyan schools has done just enough to be part of what has brought the infection rate down in that country, because the kids had a right to the information.
I like that, you know, and it's so great that you're bringing in the international aspect of it as well. To follow up on Eleanor, one of the good stories, even though we had the situation in Harlem when we had the first AIDS in the black community, I was listening to the sister yesterday, and what was intriguing about, there's this great quote, don't mourn, organize, if there's a need, fill it. There was a young sister in Harlem, a lot of black churches in Harlem, but there was a lot of silence. It's like, what's that word? Silence was deafening. And she said, what would happen if we just started an organization in which we would go to our respective black churches and talk to the church? And by the way, with all due respect, it's the women of the church. And they started Balm in Gilead. Think about that. Didn't have nothing, just a thought, started it. And started that conversation, which now has led on to having a lot more people within our black churches having this conversation as well. But what I want to talk about, something to follow up on Eleanor, is our historically black colleges. We're in the South. There's 105 of them. And an estimated 300,000 students, and given the age of where they are, one of the things that the National Black Justice Coalition was trying to figure out is how do we have a conversation within our HBCU. So we started an initiative, and if you go to nbjc.org, it's all on there, and I think there's a way, I think Lynn is in her way to upload some of this stuff, post whatever. But here's and there's like five or six things. One of them is, you know, it has to be inclusive. There needs to be some way in which you are kind of a welcoming campus. And Quan, honestly, thank you for the A, the Allies. There's only two campuses in the entire country of an HBCU that have a full-time paid staff in office. One of them is North Carolina Central University, right up here in Durham, North Carolina. Thank you, Tia Marie Doxey, straight ally, who said, we have got to be concerned about our students. They also have a faculty group. But here's one of the things that we advocate. Focus areas should include mental and emotional health services, sexual health services, transition-related care for transgender students. They do exist on our campuses. Student life and student housing. So if you add into what Eleanor had talked about, and if you overlay that on a student population, which is our future leaders, many of them will go on to be, then how do you begin to have that? But talk about it in a way that black folk can understand the conversation. I think the technical term is cultural competence. It's called, you hear what I'm saying? but that's part of it. And also, because of Obama, and in fact, our CEO, Executive Director, Sharon Littman Hicks, you know her alumnus, she's an alumni of what? FAMU, Florida AMU, down here in Tallahassee, Florida. She's a Delta, no shade. But you know, but the AKAs and the Deltas are on, we're on this together. We have that in common. But just to wrap up, because Obama was, because of just his initiative and new administration, they had an HBCU initiative in which we brought into the fold this issue about what happens on our campuses to help the mental health and literally the physical health of these students. And because of that, and working with the National Education Association, NEA, again, another great partnership, this has gone a whole lot more further than if you and I, Joe, or you or me, and want to get out there and have the conversation, because it's infrastructure that makes it happen. And so I will also say, we're sitting in Atlanta. What do you all have? Seven of them around y'all. Clark, what do you have? Clark Atlanta, Spelman, Morehouse. And one of the great things about Morehouse, the downside is, you might have heard the story a few years ago. There was a student who was perceived to be gay, nearly beaten to death. He wasn't. But because of that incident, and I don't know why it takes something that bad to make people wake up and say, maybe we should have a conversation about this now. They now have at Morehouse and at Spelman and other campuses, not full-time paid offices and staff, but they now have an organization that's a safe zone on that campus. You cannot go to a school and feel like you cannot be protected, cannot be welcomed, if there's not an infrastructure that's around you. And then also talk about the Alumni Association. So I just think that, you know, once again, we were just talking about my sense of optimism is right here. And it's just a question of how do we collectively figure out how we have these conversations, not only in English, to move us forward. So this is just one example of how we're doing that work on our HBCUs.
Oh, come on. I was afraid we weren't going to get our last slide. All of you work in the area of combating STIs, either through prevention, identification, treatment, care, etc. So what does all of this mean for the work that you do and the work that I try to help you do, in a sense? What it means is that, though I said earlier that STIs are not anomalous, they're not exceptional, they also are not evenly distributed across the population. Again, yesterday you saw that in terms of various slides and various presentations. What this means is that we need to work together with groups, with communities where STIs are the highest, and learn about the sexual culture of those communities and how STIs fit into it. I go around the world. I've done work in Thailand. I've done work in Kenya, as you've heard, Nigeria, Rwanda, various other countries. So it's obvious to me that I have to figure out what the sexual culture is of the people that I'm working with, because I'm not at home. It's not something that I'm familiar with. But I would like to suggest to you that is also the case here at home in the United States or in Canada, because I've done work also with newcomers to Canada. And I know that the sexual culture of young people who come from Muslim countries is different than the sexual culture of young people that come from the Caribbean, is different than the sexual culture of young people who immigrate from India, and I could go on and on and on. Which means that if I want to have effective programming, if I want to have programming, preventions, messages, whatever it is I'm doing that reaches them, that speaks to them, and that makes sense to them, I have to learn from them. I have to work with them. So the foundation of praxis in this area is recognizing that we need to respect and we need to partner with people in the communities and the groups that we work with and learn about them. I would say that that's a rights and a justice issue. They have their own sexual culture. They have their own way of looking at things, and they have a right to have that respected. I was born in the United States, and I believe very much in the melting pot. My own parents were immigrants to the United States, and they stressed to us, Eleanor and my brother Stan and Alice, become American. We are in America. Become American. I then, as a young adult, moved to Canada and learned a new approach, multiculturalism. Respect your own culture. Value your own culture. Meld it together to create the culture of Canada. I kind of like my chosen country over where I was born. And that has been a watchword of my research, and I think it's a cornerstone of good praxis in this area. Respecting the culture of other people and working within it and developing programs that work for them. So in early research I did in the 1990s in Thailand, it was a matter of coming to understand how the culture of sexuality and STIs could be worked with to lower the rate of, at that time I was called in to work on HIV infection. And what we did is we worked with people in rural villages to understand what the norms and the belief systems were around the acceptability, in fact, the encouragement to men to have multiple sexual partners while their female partners stayed at home, their wives stayed at home. How this was acceptable, how it was acceptable to women, how it was acceptable to men. What we learned was there was a whole list of rules that people were expected to follow. What we did is we worked with those rules. As a sociologist, I call them norms and mores. We worked with those norms to develop a way of understanding HIV infection and how to prevent HIV infection. The systems we worked out, the interventions, the strategies, I've been privileged to every few years get word from yet another PhD student or postdoc somewhere in Europe, North America, who has gone to Thailand to examine how things are going with respect to HIV infection and how people are responding. And I get emails saying, those programs that we put in place are still in place. Not because I'm great, but because the programs were within the context of the sexual culture of the communities and the people that worked with us to design them. So that's what I would say. People have a right to have their sexual culture respected and understood. And if we want to combat STIs, we have to work within that context.
Thank you, Eleanor. Now, on the slide, it says praxis. So I said, what does that mean? And then, Lisa, I think you said, what it means, now what? What now? Yeah, so what, now what? So what, now what? So I have a couple of thoughts just to pass on. First of all, nbjc.org, please look at that. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. I don't know all these things, but we're there on the social media. But one thing, we just got done this past weekend. There was a time when black folk couldn't vote in this country, and nor women. But now we have a thing called the Congressional Black Caucus. And again, by forming a partnership with the Congressional Black Caucus, we were just at our seventh annual Out on the Hill. Out on the Hill is actually a way in which we have, we call legislative policy. We have a White House briefing every year in which we bring advocates, faith leaders, civic leaders, activists together, all together in Washington, D.C., purposely timed to coincide with the Congressional Black Caucus's Foundation Annual Legislative Conference. So this was our seventh, and we were there at the 46th. We have a table there. We do a number of panels there. But also, again, that's the partnership of who represents us as a community. So one of the highlights, does anyone know Congresswoman Representative Barbara Lee from California, very outspoken, strong woman? They did a panel in conjunction with the National Black Justice Coalition. It was called Tipping Point, Fast Tracking the End of AIDS. Why not think forward? But that was the conversation we're having about what it is now, where the potential could be, and what has to happen to move it forward. So we always collaborate with the Congressional Black Caucus. That said, I was just downstairs when you do these posters, you know, and the poster I looked at was THP Poster 65, and it was around Durham, North Carolina, where I live, Durham County. There's 100 counties in North Carolina. I was shocked to see this figure. That Durham County, roughly 300,000 people, and I'm sure Yulin, you know this too, we need to have this conversation, it said that Durham County has one of the highest rates of newly diagnosed HIV persons in the state. But also our governor, I don't want to get into politics, but McCrory decided to opt out of the Affordable Care Act. You see the price that we're paying for this is outrage, outrage. But what I liked is that, again, the idea, Duke University, Lincoln Community Health Center, UNC Chapel Hill, figured out a way along with the county health department and to see how do we collaborate to deal with something that doesn't exist. You have to figure out a way to fill this void. And the fact that they had those figures up and were talking about the reality, I lived there. I know exactly what that looks like. Before I got into Medicare, I had not one bit of health insurance. The only place I could go down was the Lincoln Community Health Center. You know who's sitting in those rooms? Black, brown, and poor white folk. Let's just put it on the table. That's who's sitting in that room. But it's the same people sitting down at the courthouse, too. You see a pattern here? And it's not a coincidence. So when we're talking about societal issues and policy, there's a connection. And what do we do around that with advocacy and the work that we do our organizing? Practical lesson learned. Back in the early, I ran into, I think she's here, Jacqueline Clymore, if you're in the house. Back in the early 80s when I moved to Durham, North Carolina, we had a thing called the Lesbian Gay Health Project. It was located on 9th Street. With all due respect, it's right not far from Duke's campus. No public transportation, but the client base was almost all black. And someone said maybe we should have a conversation about keep it where you are on 9th Street, but then set up a desk or something over in Fayetteville Street, which is the predominantly black neighborhood. And because of that one thought and that one suggestion, that happened. And that was 23 years ago. I just saw her, wherever you are. And I'm sitting here thinking, how are we all now? Oh, there you raise your hand. There you are. Thank you. You know? And so who knew that these are the things that were going to go on? And then wrapping up, I was going to also just say that one of the things that we put out is this thing called All God's Children. It's a short documentary, got nominated for an Academy Award. You know what it is? It's about having a conversation within our black churches about whether or not we are part of All God's Children. Are we part of the spiritual community or not? And so you have people like Cornel West and Jesse Jackson and Maxine Waters having the conversation, and it's out there as well. But also developing faith-based information as well. So we have this thing called Guide to Welcoming Congregations in American Tradition. I want to end with something about why my little chat had justice or just us. I am really struck by where we are in the year 2016. And when you think about our lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community and how far we have come, both culturally, socially, you name it. Thank you, Salt and Pepper, for that great song, Let's Talk About Sex. But we also get wins in the courts, and we got some major U.S. Supreme Court wins recently. Thank you, Edie Windsor. Defense of Marriage Act laid the foundation for now what we have, full marriage equality. Not gay marriage equality, to thank the people who came before us around marriage equality, interracial marriage, so on. But the Supreme Court giveth and it taketh away. And at the same time they gave a great win on DOMA, they all but destroyed the 1965 Voting Rights Act. That was devastating. If anyone stood on that bridge last year in Selma, Edmund Pettus Bridge, where people gave their lives for the right to vote, think about it. So one of the rhetorical questions I think we get to ask is this question. Against the backdrop of the wins of the LGBT community, when you think about people of color and other communities trying to also get full equality and justice for all, are we about justice or are we about just us? That's where we're sitting right now. But here's the good news. If we're about justice, it includes us. If we get to understand how we have to be in conversation, how we have to be in collaborations and communications and organizing. And then once again, the backdrop of social justice and how we move all of us forward collectively. So it's not a question of if, I think it's a question of when. So with that said, Q&A. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eleanor and Mandy. I don't know about you, but boy, 8 o'clock in the morning is a beautiful hour, isn't it? I feel really inspired. And I think I have to just say personally, given the news of this week, I needed to hear those talks. And so thank you very much. So now we're open for a Q&A. And so if you'll please come to the mic, we have time for questions. No. He's working on it.
Hello. Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi.
No.
Testing 1, 2. Hi. I'm a graduate student at the University of Illinois Chicago School of Public Health. And I identify as a millennial, and I hope to be an aspiring leader in the field of STD prevention. And I was wondering if I could ask the moderators, which thank you so much for organizing this, and it's incredibly inspiring. What lessons would you offer to millennials who want to be future leaders in this field? And what lessons in the context of social justice?
There you go, Eleanor. I'll follow up on you. Good question.
Well, it depends on what kind of leadership you want to take in the field. There are so many different areas. As someone who's an academic who does research, I would say if that's the path you wish to follow, I would say, get your education, get your credentials. And as you turn to doing research and you turn to doing teaching, think about the communities you're working with. Essentially what I said in my last few comments, how essential it is, what I have found throughout my career, is that I have learned as much by working together with communities and with community representatives as I have by sitting in my office and analyzing the data. And in fact, when I get data and I look at it and I say, what in the world? I mean, I can have all my coefficients, I can have all my levels of significance, and it's when I go back out into the community and talk to people and I say, what does this mean? That they put the flesh on the bones of the statistics. So I can have a map, and the maps yesterday that Mary Bassett put up were so illustrative and so important to show where the inequalities are and that they cut across so many areas. What does that mean in people's lives? That's where I go out to the community. So I would say that if that's the route you're following, keep your feet on the ground in the communities you're working in. If your route is activism, it's the same thing. You're smack dab in the middle of communities because that's where activism is. And that's where the two of us come together, is the fact that, my skill set is research. But I'm dependent on, I have to work together with Mandy. And with people like Mandy and the group she works with, their skill set is how to get to the people, how to understand the people, how to advocate, how to be activists. But what they tell me is, but we need the data. We need that information, because if we've got that information, we can move forward with it. Mm-hmm. So that's the advice I give you. I don't know. Hopefully.
And also, I love your question for the other reason. It's we're in a place where demographics are having a huge role to play. Can I get a quick show of hands of anyone born post-World War II, the years between 1946 and 64? Anyone born in those years? There's 79 million of us. That's the 60s generation. Everything from LGBT, women, right, whatever. But now, anyone between the ages of 18 to 25, millennials, can you raise your hand? 80 million. I can count. So they might not be in this room today, but I'm thinking when you're having this conversation, that's the pool that we get to work with, and I'm so struck. I only know how to do Facebook. I don't know how to do anything else. Someone's going to teach me how to do Twitter or something like that. But I'm also going to ask you, I'm assuming that whatever your profession might be as millennial, social media, there's other creative ways, right, in which that work gets done. And then the question is, how do we have an intergenerational multiracial, multi-issue conversations to again move us all forward. So boy, we need you. But that's a huge number for all of us to think about that. Thank you for your question.
Yes, thank you. Jason?
Is that thing working yet? Or?
Yeah, I think it is.
Okay.
So it's going to sound adversarial, but it is not meant to be.
We'll give that to Eleanor.
No. Isn't adversary part of activism anyway?
Well, actually, Dr. Matukatinda, you actually provided me a lot of inspiration when I was doing my thesis at San Diego State. So very much respect to everybody up there. And, you know, Joe, I love you. So with the topic, the title of this presentation, and in the area of social justice, which I think sort of highlights the differences between having diversity and having inclusion, I think that we would have an interesting response from the Black community if I had a panel with a Native American, a Latino, and two white women,
with you,
and not a single Black person. And yet we continue panel after panel, presentation after presentation, topic after topic.
Yes.
We exclude Native Americans and Latinos.
Like it.
You have a...
And when I appreciate what you said, and I think this is so... Maybe this is American society. We always live in an either-or. It's not. It's a both-and. And if you take the time to have these conversations with the kind of GM, whatever the breakout, the demographics might be, we need to do it. And also, like I said, not only in English and the cultural stuff, I'm with you. So are you suggesting that for... Is this every 2 years, this conference? When's the next one? It's going to be 2018. So yeah. You got that? Thank you. But I love it. Thank you so much. That's
Thank
where
you.
It's at. I appreciate it.
Hi, Harlan Roblatt, Los Angeles County. I want to ask a question about this idea of meeting people where they are. That's, you know, we all embrace that, of accepting sort of the sexual culture or the mores of a group to reach out to them. But I'm also struck that, you know, sort of our existence as a field and our existence as a conference is in a way a pushback against the prevailing sexual mores and sexual culture of the United States. We just now, in January 1, finally got a mandate for comprehensive sex education in California. With the California Healthy Youth Act. I've had conversations already at this conference about people who are amazed with that, to not be able to have that in their jurisdiction here in 2016. So how do you reconcile the idea of this sort of inclusion and sensitivity? You know, we're dealing in LA County, I'm sure elsewhere across the country, with crushing disparities in STI burden that are half a century old or older. Again, produced by these prevailing sexual mores. We're dealing with, you know, HB2, we could go on and on.
Yeah.
So it's like, how can we not be raging and being activists against these prevailing sexual culture?
Mm-hmm. You know, I guess the question I always wonder, when we went back to say, don't mourn, organize it, there's a need, fill it, I sat in the opening plenary. And I was really struck by just how people, like when ASHA was formed in 1914, because someone said, there's something we need to do about this issue, what was the prostitution and whatever. I wonder sometimes, and this could be a both end, it's like what we can do to literally put stuff on the books, whether it's a cultural thing or a medical thing or pass it by law, but that doesn't prevent people getting up and just on their own creating things around them that makes it possible to have these conversations. I think when we had what was the name that we made? Like at the Lincoln Community Health Center, there's a huge Latina community. There's people who are not doctors, but there's an in-between. What's that name? There's a name for that. There's an in-between person. There's
patient navigator.
And there's no reason why people have to kind of wait around to get permission. You know, and I think that's what's been so dynamic about the kind of movements that we've had. And are you asking by the people of the people for the people? Because you're going to be more apt to get that information more correctly, culturally and otherwise. But also I would suggest this, and this is something we've been pondering when we think about students of color going onto campuses. Where's the funds, or how to create an opportunity for people to go on to the social schools of social work, or public policy advocates or doctors who can speak the language and have the culture, but you don't have to wait for permission necessarily, waiting for some legal. I'm just saying that in terms of how I've been seeing how things organize without always getting the kind of recognition. I'm not sure if that's kind of what you're asking. But people are moving on, and do we know it, though? The other question is, how do we make sure that we have the information so that gets out there? And with social media, that can be out there in a click or two, and or people don't have it, other ways to spread the word. I wouldn't want to feel too dejected or feel like it's taking a long time to get things done because people are moving on it. And I used to live in California and kind of see how that happens there as well. Just a ray of hope on this, possibly.
Yeah. The question you ask is the question that I asked right at the beginning of my work in the area of sexuality and STIs. And it's a question that I keep asking myself over and over. But one of the flaws in my thinking at the time was that there is a single sexual culture, that there is a single way of thinking about things in a particular country or even within a particular community. But what I've discovered in my own work, in my own research, is there is a diversity of views. So that there isn't one single sexual culture of the United States. If you go around the country, you speak to different groups. Mm-hmm. So, you know, are we to say that the dominant culture for people who are gay and lesbian has always been homophobia? Mm-hmm. Homophobia is part of their own lives, but there is a different set of attitudes, beliefs, etc., with respect to sexuality. So if I work with the gay and lesbian, or more recently the trans community, yeah, it's where are they at and how can I move their views forward? I frequently discover, however, I also frequently run up against, and I think we all run up against, values, attitudes, behavior patterns that work against sexual health, STI,
right,
reducing the rate of STI. So what do we do when we come across that? And I think that's where we need those open and in-depth conversations. I want to give you an illustration of a conversation that, not that I had, I wasn't wise enough or good enough to do this, but a colleague of mine, a good friend of mine, had with some religious leaders in Kenya when they were in opposition to even providing information in response to those question box questions that youth were raising with respect to condoms. And they said, they gave all the reasons that we've all heard for why you cannot tell young people about condoms. So I won't go over those. And what Mary said to this gathering of pastors and priests, she said, okay, let's talk about this. You tell me that if we tell young people, if we promote condoms among young people, it will mean that it will encourage them to be sexually active. She said, let's talk, and that sexual activity outside of marriage is a sin. She said, let's talk about sin. She said, which is the worst sin, to kill other people or to have sex? And they said, killing is a worse sin than having sex. She said, and what about suicide? Suicide is a worse sin. She had many more conversations than this. I'm paraphrasing and reducing it. But ultimately, out of that kind of conversation came the agreement that though being sexually active as a young person outside of marriage perhaps was a sin, there were far worse sins, and spreading HIV, which was a killer, or exposing yourself to the possibility of becoming infected with HIV, which at that time, when she was talking to them, was also a killer. This was before ARVs were available in the region, that perhaps the lesser of the sins was providing them with information about condoms, together with a message that this was for their future. See, there was a compromise. Still not a good idea. You still should not be sexually active as a young person who isn't yet married. But you need to know about condoms. So what that taught me was that we need to have those kinds of in-depth conversations, because quite often what appears well and what is at the superficial level or at the level that we encounter it, a belief system, a sexual culture that is just going to promote the spread of STIs. If we engage in those in-depth conversations, what we discover is that there's a way through. There's a way to manage this, and that there is a way for people to engage in behaviors, activities, initiatives that will reduce their rate of infection or will help prevent the spread of infection to others. We did a similar thing in Thailand.
It's a way of transcending barriers and
That's
creating
right.
a new opportunity.
That's right. But it's still a matter of what I've discovered is if I try to hit an attitude, a belief, a behavior pattern that works, that promotes the spread of STIs head on, I'm not going to get anywhere.
So, Eleanor, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut off your answer.
Okay.
And go to our last question.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I didn't know you could come to the microphone and say I love Joe, so I want to say that first. Thank you so much for this really excellent panel. And I want to just remind us of something. Mandy was talking about what happened to the Voting Rights Act with the Supreme Court. There probably isn't anyone here who doesn't know that women were imprisoned and lost their children for the right to vote. That black men were hung by their neckties when they got dressed up to go and to vote. And that in the next 4 to 8 years, we're probably going to lose a couple of Supreme Court justices. So a lot of those rights, the rights for people to marry whom they love, are decided at that level. So this is a pivotal year. 435 members of U.S. Congress are up for re-election, and we have a presidential election. And I want to urge people to vote for whomever you believe gets us closest to the kinds of values that we've been hearing about this morning, whomever you believe will help us to sustain the gains that we've made and not move any further back. So I'm not giving shade to anybody, but I do hope that we remember that the passion that brings us here, the thing that compels us to get up at 8 o'clock in the morning, thank you, Joe, and come to a session like this should be the passion that sends us to the polls.
Love it.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
So I want to thank everybody for this very wonderful session, and I can say I love everybody in the room, so
thank
I'm
you.
Really
Heart
glad.
And Mind Public Policy, thank
and
you so
thank
much.
You.
And we're here for the next couple of days, so if you want to have personal conversation, we're available, right? Thank you, Joe.
Yeah.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, Eleanor.